Good evening and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. Find us on the internet at www.commonwealthclub.org. I'm Ann Clark, a member of the Commonwealth Club and chair of the Environment and Natural Resources member-led forum. Our program tonight is also sponsored by the Business and Leadership member-led forum, Kevin O'Malley, the chair. Our program is On the Green Beat in the Developing World, Inner News. It is a pleasure to introduce our moderator and panelists, James Fawn, who is the Global Director of Inner News and a lecturer at UC Berkeley's Graduate School of Journalism. He's also the Executive Director of Inner News Earth Journalism Network. And James will introduce you to our outstanding worldwide experienced journalists, who are joining us tonight. And we really do appreciate the fact that they are here tonight representing Brazil, China, Kenya, and Nepal. Thank you. James?
Thank you, Anne. Thanks very much for having us here tonight. Thanks to the Commonwealth Club, and thanks to all of you for joining us on this rather steamy San Francisco evening. It's a pleasure to be here, and I'm going to quickly do an introduction of our panelists. We're very lucky to have them in town to speak with us. And then I'll talk a little bit about the Earth Journalism Network and what it is, and then we'll turn it over to them to talk more fully about their work. So immediately to my right is Gustavo Faleiros from Brazil, and he is an editor at OECO, which is a Brazilian environmental news agency. He's also a two-time Knight International Journalism Fellow and the founder and developer, editor of Info Amazonia, which I'm sure he'll be talking about more later. It's a unique, a new, innovative geojournalism platform that combines data with traditional journalism. To his right is Rosalia Omungo. Rosalia is a news editor at the Kenyan Broadcasting Corporation. She's the producer of a weekly feature program on the environment called Earthwatch. And this year, this semester, she has been selected to be the first ever Earth Journalism Scholar at the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. So we're very pleased to have her with us. To her right is Liu Litsan. Litsan started off as a TV journalist. He's now the project manager for the Earth Journalism Network in China. He's also the founder and leader of an environmental NGO called Greenovation Hub that works in China to promote fresh, clean drinking water. He's also the author of a fascinating new book on China's cancer villages, so we're hoping to learn more about that tonight. Thank you, Litsan. And to his right is Ramesh Bhushal. Ramesh is from Kathmandu, from Nepal. He's a former journalist with the Himalayan Times, and he's now the manager, the director of the Third Pole Data Network, which tries to bring together organizations around South Asia and the Himalayan region to share and report and visualize data on water and climate issues. Well, again, we'll be learning more about that. So first of all, thanks to all of you for joining us. I'd also like to quickly introduce to you, sitting beside you in the audience, another group of journalists who are, all these journalists are in town this week for a conference being held by the Earth Journalism Network. So if we could please quickly have the other journalists please stand up so the other people in the audience can know who you are. Each of them have wonderful stories to tell and have been doing amazing work as well, and there's really no reason why they couldn't be up here on the panel as well. So I hope once the panel is over, you'll also have a chance to talk to them as well. Thank you, everyone. So now let me quickly introduce to you, what is the Earth Journalism Network? What is this, this organization? So we essentially are a professional organization, a professional association of journalists around the world who cover environmental issues, and we are dedicated to improving the quantity and quality of environmental coverage. We have been around for 10 years now. This is our 10th anniversary, so we're pretty proud of that fact. And we've grown quite a bit now. We have over 4,500 journalists registered on our website from over 120 countries. This map that I'm showing, and I apologize to our radio audience, I know you can't see this presentation we're showing, but trust me, it's there. So this map shows, for instance, some of the, our regional distribution where many of our members live and work. This is not a comprehensive list, a map, but it does provide some indication. What exactly do we do? Well, we divide our activities into three categories. Our main and traditional set of activities concerns education, basically training. We work with journalists all over the world to train them in specific issues. As you can imagine, climate change is a pretty important topic we train, but also biodiversity, oceans, environmental health, forests, fisheries. We are quite flexible, agriculture, food. And we also can tailor these trainings for specific regions. So, for instance, next month we'll be holding a training in China on fisheries and ocean issues. That's been our kind of bread and butter over the years. But another set of activities is what we call networked journalism, okay? Because I was a journalist myself for many years based in Thailand. I worked there for 14 years. And one of the things I did I'm most proud of was I helped set up something called the Thai Society of Environmental Journalists. Now, you may be familiar, here in the U.S. we have a Society of Environmental Journalists. And again, these are professional associations, and they're very helpful. First of all, you can do a lot of peer-to-peer learning, so the senior journalists train the younger ones. But also, there's just more strength in numbers. And when I, as an individual journalist, would try to get, say, the Thai Minister of Industry to explain why oil companies were dumping mercury in the Gulf of Thailand, he would ignore me. But when we, as a group of journalists representing much of the country's media organizations, when we asked him to come speak with us, well, then you better believe he came and talked to us, because there's just more clout when you can work as a group. So when we set up the Earth Journalism Network 10 years ago, we said, let's build these networks where they don't exist and work with them where they do. And that's what we've done. So we've helped to launch networks in countries like Indonesia and the Philippines, and we work with existing networks all over the world, from Vietnam to Mexico to China, wherever we can. Our third set of activities is a new endeavor. It's something we call geo-journalism. It takes advantage of the fact that there's a lot more environmental data out there now in the world than there used to be. And we have new ways to map and visualize that data that help to explain what's going on in the world around us in a very evidence-based way. So these journalism platforms, geojournalism platforms, they're based on interactive maps, and they have layers of data combined with traditional news stories that are geotagged. I'll be showing you some examples. I also want to mention the fact that we largely focus on developing countries because, that's where most of the world's people live. 80% of the world's population is in the developing world. It contains most of the world's remaining biodiversity. It's got the world's fastest growing economies. And essentially, we believe this is where the future of our planet is going to be decided. Now, that said, increasingly we see the distinction between developed and developing countries as becoming less and less meaningful. We're increasingly working in the U.S., in Europe, in Japan as well. But still, our traditional area of focus has been the developing world. Here you can see a quick list of many of our regional partners. I'm not going to go through them all, but just to show you that there's a lot of activity going on out there on environmental journalism. And we're just going to kind of show you the tip of the iceberg here. But I just want to show you that there is a lot going on. And finally, I'd like to show you some of the impacts that we've had over the years. As I mentioned, we now have over 4,500 members. We've trained over 3,300 journalists over the last 10 years, again, in all different subjects. And these journalists have produced over 4,500 stories just during our activities. Of course, they go back home to their media houses and they produce many more. And these stories have had real-world consequences. So, and I'd be happy to talk more about this if you like, but for instance, a group of journalists in Vietnam ended up saving a national park that was slated for some ruinous development plan. A journalist in China uncovered illegally polluting factories that were then shut down. Journalists in Burma helped to publicize the problems with a dam that was being built on the headwaters of the Irrawaddy River, and that project has been scrapped, at least shelved for the time being, and on and on. We can all tell you stories about the impacts that journalism has had on the environment, and that's, you know, one of the reasons many of us work in this field. That's our organization. That's why we're here. We're in town to talk about new strategies, new ways that journalists can use data, can use citizen science to try and get more information to report to the public. And so we're going to be talking about that now in more detail with our panelists. I'd like to first ask Gustavo, if you could talk a little bit about the work you're doing in Brazil. What are the top stories, the top issues that you're covering, and you know what is the public in Brazil most interested in?
Thank you, James. So I started covering environmental issues, really focused on climate change. When I started, it was the biggest issue, like the carbon credits were starting. There was a lot of discussion about how forestry could benefit Brazil. I don't know if you heard about the scheme called RED. It stands for reducing emissions of deforestation and forest degradation. So that's more or less the landscape when I started covering. But over the years, what I noticed, and I think still is important, and the main field we've been working, deforestation keeps being a kind of a major indicator of environmental health in Brazil. So it's funny because most of people live in cities in Brazil, and if you go to Rio or São Paulo and you ask what's the environment for you, they will say it's the Amazon. Or the view people has about Brazil outside of Brazil also is related with the Amazon rainforest. So the Amazon rainforest is this icon which represents, as I said, a kind of an environmental indicator. So I've been working a lot on the impacts of deforestation on, for example, on climate. It's a very interesting scientific topic of what is going to happen if the climate really gets warmer and how this would affect species or even the kind of the vegetation of the Amazon. So that's been a bigger interest to me over the years, and that's why we started working with data, scientific data coming from satellites on forest fire and other issues. Now, what I think right now it's more important, of bigger interest or a growing interest of the Brazilian audience has been, I think, lucky enough, urban issues. I don't know if you saw last year the big demonstrations we had in Brazil, but those demonstrations, although they're not directly related to environmental issues, they were related with transportation and public transportation, the quality of public transportation and quality of life. And you can extrapolate this with all the issues of like taxes that and incentives that are given to car manufacturers in Brazil, which is totally linked with the economy and the jobs that are created by the car manufacturers. So I think this is a very kind of a question, an issue that goes through different sectors of Brazilian society, but it shows a kind of a maturity also for discussing the environmental issue. So it's an interesting topic to pay attention over the next years, I would say.
Can I just follow up with a question about, can you talk a little bit more about Info Amazonia, this geojournalism project you launched? And I can show a screenshot of it here.
Yeah. So Info Amazonia is really a dream project to us in our organization, and especially to me, because it kind of congregates a lot of the experience we've been accumulating over these years of covering the Amazon. So we started 2008 looking at data from satellites coming on forest fires, and we realized that it was a very good way of telling people the scale of the things that are happening in this region. So we're talking about a region which is 7 million square kilometers. I don't know a good comparison to the U.S., but I know it's the size of Australia. So 9 countries, not just Brazil. So that's another issue which has become very important to us for, as a Brazilian, to communicate to my peers that the Amazon is just not Brazil. We are very proud to say, like, Brazil owns the Amazon, which is not true. Like, we're 9 countries, you know? And there was crazy dynamics going on out there of occupation, building dams and roads. So it's a 7 million square kilometers country changing in front of your eyes. So InfoAmazonia tries to show, in first place, I would say, the scale of transformation of such an important region. So you what you do is you bring all the data you find on satellites showing this large-scale transformation and try to reach out for the journalists who are in the ground to kind of start dialoguing with this data. That's what it does. Like, the data is giving context to the stories, but the journalists on the ground gives context to the data. Because if you're looking at the satellites, nice, it's changing, but what's the story? Who is changing? Who are the people who are cutting down the streets? So that's what kind of the importance of journalism in this context of large, big data sets.
Okay, thank you, Gustav. Rosalia, what's going on in Kenya? What are the big issues there? What's your work focus on there?
Okay, so currently there are very many issues going on in environment journalism that make important stories for journalists. One of the greatest thing I feel like has been given prominence is poaching, which to Kenya, Kenya's wildlife is one of the greatest tourist attraction, and so poaching, especially of elephants for ivory, has increased, and the population of elephants is diminishing by the day. So that's one of the major issues that is has been given prominence in Kenya right now, and the First Lady of Kenya has actually been incorporated as an ambassador, you know, for the campaign to save the elephants. They call it Hands of Our Elephants. You may have seen it somewhere. So that's one of the major issues happening in Kenya. But we also have serious issues happening around climate change. We have lots of forest destruction. That was happening. I think campaigns really do work, and In the last 3 years, there has been a lot of forest destruction, but a similar campaign that was taken up at the policy level, you know, at the office of the Prime Minister, took up the challenge to spearhead a campaign to save forests in Kenya, and that really worked, and that made Kenyans so aware of, you know, we cannot destroy forests, we have to save forests. And when the campaign began, it was picked up, you know, entirely by the entire country, so that every organization wants to have their name, you know, to have their foot into the campaign, and a lot of money was poured into that. So forest destruction, right now, it still remains a big story, because the authorities claim that there is a lot of collusion between the workers in the parks and poachers themselves, or loggers. So we also have issues to do with pollution. We have one of the biggest lakes, the biggest freshwater lake in Africa, Lake Victoria, is located in western Kenya, and right now, we don't know who will save the lake. All we see is, you know, the government officials going to visit the lake, you know, which is covered in water hyacinth. That's an invasive species. So when you stand here, the lake stretches far, and you see just a sea of green. And that's affecting a lot of sections of the lake. And there was talk that a certain a certain insect would be introduced to eat up the hyacinth. We haven't seen that yet. That remains a big story in Kenya right now, and I'm not seeing it being addressed right now. And then pollution as well is another. In Kenya, there is no waste management policy, so that dumping happens anywhere. So we have a very big dump site called Dandora, where it becomes a free-for-all space where people just go and dump their waste there. So no one really cares. So it's been taken over by street urchins. They camp there, they live there, they go to scavenge for food in there, and they attack people in there, you know. So it's just a money-minting business for some people, yet there are neighborhoods around there, you know, neighborhoods of people that live around there and are affected by pollution. So I think those are some of the key issues that Kenya is grappling with right now. So we're yet to see a waste management policy put in place.
Rosalia, you were telling me that ethnic conflict is a big problem in Kenya, and that you actually investigated a story, mm-hmm. I believe, in the coastal region, mm-hmm. in the Delta region, looking into why the people there are fighting over natural resources. Do you want to talk a little bit about that story and what you discovered? Okay. What's the cause of that?
Okay, so there is a region in Kenya called the Tana Delta region. It's in the coastal area of Kenya. And it is very rich. It has got such agriculture potential. But this region, the coastal region, is basically a cosmopolitan area. There are people of different communities have settled in the coastal region. So the original people whose land that is are the coastal people. They're basically agricultural. They farm. They farm in their shambas, and they produce crops. And then we have the pastoral communities who have come and settled there. So they usually migrate in search of pasture for their animals and settle down in a place where they find pasture for their animals. Then later on, they move to a different place when the place becomes dry. So these people have been coexisting. For years, they've been coexisting, but one time suddenly, 2012, just violence just broke out, and they started fighting. Two communities just began to fight. And so I wrote a proposal to go and investigate really what really happens here. I wanted to speak to the people living in the Tana Delta region. And when I went, I found people actually, some were returning because a curfew had been declared in that area, and policemen had taken over many of the villages because people started fighting, they killed each other, so people fled the villages. So when I went to investigate the story, they were actually returning to the communities to rebuild their communities, but they were living in fear. So what they were saying is that it's a conflict of pasture. You know, they are fighting for resources there. But what they also said is that what also puzzled me is that it happens a few months to elections. It happens just some months before elections or the year before elections. So I talked to a number of people, especially the old people, who said that we've been living together very well, but politicians come to divide us. So what I realized was that the politicians come to divide them to make them fight over land, over a natural resource. So they use a natural resource as a tool to fight local communities. So that what they were saying is that the members of the pastoral community come in and graze their cattle on their crops that have grown. They let them walk over their maize and over their beans, you know, so blatantly, and then they move away. So that angers them. And this happens, this incitement comes because many of the politicians want to have votes during the elections. So when they spark the violence, people move out, and the people that remain are their own, who will vote for them. So that's what I discovered from that investigation. So when policemen come in, there's some uneasy calm returns. So right now it's a bit quiet. I've not heard of incidences there. So I don't know whether that will be maintained in the next election. We will see about that. But the trend is that the fighting occurs just before elections. So natural resources have been used as a tool, you know, by politicians to fight, you know, communities that are willing to coexist peacefully.
Thank you, Rosalia. Nitsan, China.
Yeah.
Rapidly growing country. I think everyone here, you know, is very curious about what's going on there in terms of the environment, maybe a little scared about what's going on, and I'm sure you have a lot of insights to share.
Well, I'm going to say that everything, you name it, in terms of environmental problems, we have problems other countries in the world have experienced centuries ago or experiencing or will face, because we have a lot of environmental issues in China now, from natural resource, energy, to soil degradation or erosion, to biodiversity loss, climate change. And what is the real hot topic in recent years is about pollution, especially air pollution, because in recent 3 years in Beijing or other northern cities in China, the air is horrible. But besides that, there's water pollution and the soil pollution. The government is just released a report on China's soil pollution. It is said that one-fifth of China's farmland is heavily polluted, which means that if you grow crops on those farmland, the food might not be safe. You can imagine that if China is short of, it needs a lot of food from other countries, there will be a problem not only for China, but for the international society, right? It's not only about environment or food safety, it's about economic or even politics. So it's highly related to many other social sectors. It's just happening every day and everywhere in China. So I always say that China now is the real gold mine of environmental reporting, because you can find very touching or miserable or good stories about every aspect.
Yes, Lisan, and actually here in the U.S., we just had a book on cancer, Cancer Village, won a Pulitzer Prize. It's called Tom's River. If you haven't had a chance to read it, I recommend it. And you have just published a book on cancer villages in China, and I know it's been very difficult publishing that book. Do you want to talk a little bit about your research and what you discovered and how you went about publishing this work?
I didn't get my book published in mainland, so I made it in Hong Kong. So it's just cancer village is a term. It's a loose term. It's not a scientific term. It refers to those rural areas where the cancer rate is relatively higher than the normal level. People think that it is related to environmental pollution. But we are not sure, because there's no real scientific investigation on that. So it's about the health consequences of pollution. Not only about that, because I have been to more than 20 of those villages in all across China, and I talked to the local people there to see how they survive and how they fought against the pollution or even the government. They told me their stories, so I basically is I'm not a journalist anymore, but it's still more like a story collecting book. But seeing that I tend to analyze the social causes or the social consequences of environmental problems in China, and I think the cancer village is one of the most extreme cases. in terms of environmental problems because it is so related to lives or humans' bodies. But there are many other parts behind the environmental problems. So it also links to the governance, to the law, to the idea of economic growth and development. So I tend to talk a little bit about those stuff in my book, and of course I want more people to know what is happening in China and how we can deal with such stuff. I hope that the more people know about the situation, the easier or the sooner we can get something better.
And before I let you go, I have to ask also about climate change, because of course that's a huge issue of concern here. And while the U.S. was historically the world's largest emitter of greenhouse gases, now of course China has taken over as the largest emitter. And so I know a lot of people here are just curious, what is the view in China on climate change? Is it considered a high priority issue? Are people worried about that, or is it something that's less of a priority? What do you think?
I think people believe in the climate is changing, but seeing that there are many other topics, the urgent topics like pollution. So climate change is not that hot in recent years, but once there's an extreme weather event, it is happening every year. So people will talk, it is because of climate change, so we should do something. But seeing that in China, the public participation in decision-making is not that good. Everyone knows that. So it's very hard for the public or the ordinary people to influence the government officials or the policies. What we can do is that we can do by ourselves to live sustainable lives. Or we can advocate that there should be a change in terms of policy on energy or consumption or natural resources. But still, I mean, the climate change is one topic we should address more, and we should to put more resources to try to tackle this problem.
Thank you. Ramesh, Nepal, high up in the Himalaya. What's going on there? What are the big issues there? What do you see as engaging the public, and what issues are you focused on?
Thank you, James. many people know about China and India, but we are the people in between, so we are sandwiched between these big countries. So you can feel how it is to be in between India and China. So you can just stand up and just close your eyes, and in 60 seconds you can see you're suffocating. It happens because of we have mountains. We have the Mount Everest. We can just climb up and say, okay, we are very happy people. But if you are in between that one, it is very hard to be there, because geologically also it is very complex. We have the world's 10 tallest mountains in the world, and then most of the region is mountainous region. Country is quite poor, and there's a very complex geopolitical situation. So the West and other countries want to be there in some way in India and China, and then the politics is going on. So that is a geopolitically complex region, and also geographically also it is a complex region because of the mountains and other things. So if you see the whole region, we talk about Hindu Kush Himalaya region. We talk about it. So it is a 3,500 kilometer long stretch of mountains, and then there are 8-9 countries who share this boundary. And then if you see this one, world's 10 largest river originate from the Himalayas. So it is the world's largest depository of the fresh water. And if you see, more than 2 billion people live in this region. So it is almost half of the world's population. So it is quite complex. It is very, very important for the environmental issues. There's deforestation, there's pollution, all those things are going on. But the most important thing is water, So there is a very, 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 very high competition between the countries to harness the water for economic purposes. If you see, there are more than thousands of hydropower has been planned. Some are under construction. So if you see like if you see the river, then it is like a pool. I mean, it has been blocked in every 100 meters, and then you can see it is not a river. It is a kind of a pool that had been developed in the region, and mostly in China and India are like China is an upstream in Tibet, and the rivers flow down to India and Bangladesh from Pakistan or Afghanistan to Myanmar. So I mean, the China is in the upper stream, and then the problem is like China and India don't want to share the data about the water resources, for example, because they want to harness more hydropower in their region, so they don't want to say how much water will discharged in the lower stream, and India want to have a lot of hydropower in that region to get this electricity, and that is one kind of economic aspect that has been into the region. And the second is like, if you see, by the climate change impact, the science has told that, okay, it says that the mountains are melting at higher rate. So it means in one century or in 50 years, there won't be ice in the Himalayas. So that is a kind of issue for people who are depending on the water there. So more than 2 billion people will be suffering from the water scarcity or kind of thing. And then there will be a lot of problem with the biodiversity as well, because if there is no water the incidents that are happening more frequent, like floods or all those things, and that will hamper the whole 2 billion people in the region. So that is the emerging issue there, and it has been very hard to do the research as well, because the countries can do a joint research because they don't want to share the data. So if we do a kind of research in Nepal, you can do it in China, or India doesn't allow to do some research in Indian part, or Afghanistan or Pakistan may not do it because they have a political reasons not to share data due to security reasons or other reasons. So it happens like it is very, very complex geologically, and it is very complex geopolitically as well. So that is a very, very tough job for the journalist to write, how to write about it, how to do a reasonable story or do a better story, because you don't get more data or more information about it.
You were listening to the Commonwealth Club of California Radio, and this is Ann Clark. Our program tonight is Internews on the Green Belt on the Green Beat and the Developing World. And we have with us tonight Gustavo Faledros from Brazil, Li Zan from China, Rosalio Umungam from Kenya, Ramesh Bruchal from Nepal, and our moderator, James Fawn. It's come to that point in time where we have time for questions. And what we will do tonight is ask the audience for questions, and we will use the handheld mic. So let's go out and ask questions now. Who has the first question?
Hi, I have a quick question for Li Zan. You mentioned cancer villages, but can you just please describe the scene at one of these places? What is a cancer village? Who lives there? What's life like?
I cannot tell, because it's pretty normal. I mean, there's no any... I imagine that they are living a miserable lives and they complain a lot, but when I went to those villages, they are not. I mean, they are other agendas, life agendas they have to do. I mean, they want to make more money, and they want to go to the cities, and... they have maybe conflicts with the government about land or housing. So the environmental problem is really not on their top agendas, even though they are facing health problems. So if you go to these rural areas, you don't expect that they are different compared to other villages. They are almost the same. On the other side, that if you can see a lot of industries or factories around those areas, that means it's not only about this named cancer villages. There are a lot of areas that may have problems in terms of environmental degradation or in terms of health. So it's just, it's normal. It's, I don't see any strange things there.
Another question from our audience? I'm going to let you think because I know there's another question here. Great.
Well, I just going to ask perhaps our panelists, and first of all, good job. But I just ask you to reflect a little bit and give me your perspective with respect to the direction of environmental journalism in your various regions or your various countries. Just about 2000, when we had the Millennium Development Goals, the global goals, we know exactly that at the time, environmental journalism was barely gaining traction in most of the developing regions of the world, the global south in general. Next year, we will transition into the Sustainable Development Goals. Do you have a sense that we are, or environmental journalism is sort of gaining traction in a way that can actually be able to provide the sort of accountability and watchdog function that we as journalists are expected to play? Is that the sense you have moving forward into, as we begin to transition into the Sustainable Development Goals? And perhaps the second point is, what is it that we would need to do to be able to make sure that we are actually fully playing this role, to be able to make sure that moving forward, at least what we produce in terms of educating and informing, we are doing a better job to be able to bring the population either to do, just basically just change behaviors and adopt sustainable development behaviors, for instance. Just a quick reflection from any member of the panel. Thanks.
Let's actually start, James, with you, the executive director of Inner News Network.
Sure.
I think you're the person to start with. And then I would like to hear a response, a wonderful question, from each of our panelists.
Sure. Well, it's interesting that, yes, as you say, we're switching now from, the plan is to switch from the Millennium Development Goals to Sustainable Development Goals. And I think that's a positive direction. I think the Millennium Development Goals, they're certainly, they're very admirable. And I think we've done it, actually the world has done a decent job of trying to meet them, perhaps better than anyone expected we would. But I do think in the Millennium Development Goals, environmental goals were sort of an afterthought. I think there's one or two of them related to the environment, and I think it's a good sign that we're moving to sustainable development goals, and I think there'll be a much greater focus, emphasis. From what I understand, this is all still to be decided over the next year and a half. There will be a greater emphasis on the environmental issues. As for the impact of environmental journalism, it's so varied, right? Because some countries you see environmental journalism and media in general progressing and moving forward and having more impact and becoming more developed. Countries like Indonesia, for instance, has made tremendous strides, and many others. And then in some countries you have backtracking, like maybe in Russia today, or I'm afraid even in Thailand, we've seen some setbacks for the media. But I think the overall trend is positive. I think we are seeing, and that's not just because of journalism, but it's because of the advance of digital media in general, of course, social media, Facebook, Twitter, not just those, but many other platforms now. A lot more people are able to communicate and express their views on environmental issues. I think the question is, how responsible will those views be? Will they be informed by professional journalism? Will they be informed by responsible views? I don't think that will necessarily be the case. I think sometimes we'll see, it could be that, there'll be hysteria, or there'll be, sometimes irresponsible views are, because this new media format is so new, we don't always see the most responsible views come forward, and sometimes there's misunderstandings as a result of that. But I think the overall trend is positive, and if we can find a way to harness all these new media platforms, engage professional journalists and citizen journalists to speak out in a responsible and professional fashion, then I think there's a lot of potential there.
Gustavo Faladros in Brazil, and what would be your response?
I think I can answer the two questions in one. And I think I have a similar view to James, but adding the fact that I see a lot of connections between what we saw, for example, in Occupy Wall Street, or the demonstrations we had in Brazil, with the question you did about how journalists and the public, in the end, the society will perceive this new thing, sustainable development goals. Because I was in Copenhagen covering the climate summit, and I think I had a right perception at that point that there was a crisis of governance, which is linked with all these kind of things. And the first thing after Copenhagen, the people say, like, UN doesn't work. And again, when we went together, we did a big program of interviews of 30 journalists to the Rio Plus 20 when the Sustainable Development Goals were created, I felt the public kind of just didn't relate it with these major goals. And it's not fault of the journalists. I think it's a fault of the system. I think people kind of, after Copenhagen or in movements like Occupy, are much more, because of social media, looking at the self-organizing thing. Maybe it's a 70s thing coming back or something, this vibe of self-organizing communities. But it's good. I mean, like, feels good. I agree with you. The way people are working is changing. And so we were talking yesterday about the emergence of this new word, not so new, but resilience, which brings a lot of this thing about self-organizing, like the resilience of community of responding by themselves, which in my view is like, we don't trust governments. We're going to do ourselves. NGOs are for this. Well, I'm reporting on what I'm looking, but don't you agree? It's kind of something that is going on. So I'm doubtful that we as environmental journalists will be able to grasp people's attention on talking of something so generical on UN terms as sustainable development goals. Although we might reach them because of the people, I don't think politically will be perceived as something meaningful.
Well, I happen to remember the 70s well. And I would like to see them come back. Rosario Omunga, Mungo from Kenya, and your response?
Yeah, I think Kenya being a developing country, I think environmental journalism has come far. That's what I would say, that many media houses are taking the environment quite importantly. They're taking it seriously, and I see, like, in every media house there is a segment on environment or a pullout in the newspapers dedicated to environment. And that stems from a reporter who took up the issue seriously and decided that that will be their beat. So it comes from a journalist taking the initiative and not necessarily the media houses. And in media houses where a top editor has an environment background, then we see more of environment stories in the editorial agenda. And that's a good thing. So I think we've come from far, and you don't necessarily have to fight for so much space. You know, you don't have to, like they say, we don't have to fight for so much space with political stories. If the story is good, it's good, and it finds its way in the editorial agenda. But moving forward, what I think that will help to boost environmental journalism, like James and Gustavo said, is we have to embrace technology. We have to learn the new things that are coming up. This morning we've been in a very intense session, you know, learning about how to monitor air pollution and, you know, and even noise pollution, and really how to deal with maps, like what Gustavo is doing. We have to embrace technology, you know, in our reporting as new information comes up, new programs come up. So we have to embrace that and make it relevant to today's generation. So I think that is something that we'll have to do moving forward to stay relevant in the profession.
Alizan from China.
Hi, things a little bit different in China, because the thing is that in general, the number of readers and audiences for media is declining. But for covering environment, it is pretty good, because the government tend to tolerate the critics from the media or from the ordinary people on those environmental issues, because there is an environmental crisis in China. So you must to do something. And if you control too tightly with those reporting, just people complain a lot. And for most of those environmental reporting, that environmental accents are more local, so central government feels no much pressure. So this is good way for environmental journalism, because you can generate to report whatever you want. You can criticize the central government, criticize the law and the policies, and relate it to other, you know, political corruption or the ideas of economic growth or other social issues, which is quite promising. So there's good news. I think this month, the China's new environmental protection law was passed by the People's Committee. It is said that is the best law in history in China to protect the environment. But before that, the media criticized the government a lot about the old law. So you can see that, you know, there will be a change if the environmental journalists can do something, you know, to help to make things better.
Ramesh Bhushal from Nepal, your country is right in the middle and has suffered a lot. What do you see happening?
Things are going on everywhere. Like, there are problems everywhere. There is problem in the U.S., there is problem in China, there is problem in India, everywhere. The problem is the thing is, like, the world has become so smaller. So you also use iPhone and I also use iPhone. You also watch television, I also watch television. There was a very huge gap between the developing, poor, and the rich countries, but it has been changed differently by the technology. So yes, your internet speed should be high. I mean, it be high, but mine may be low, but I also use emails. So people have become smart. They have the technology, they have embraced technology. So what we need to do is, like, I mean, there are some jargons that have been used globally, and there are some global politics that are going on. But what I think is, like, that is the opportunity to work together, you know. So, I mean, at least people are talking about environmental issues, climate change every year. That didn't happen 30 years back. So at least people are talking about meeting, talking about things, and at least they are trying to do something else. So that is a kind of thing that happens with this UN things. But I agree with Gustavo that, I mean, it will not solve it. Because if you vote something here, then there will be two people that deny and this, and there will be 10 people who accept it. So, I mean, you can go a global consensus and find out the solution. But definitely what I believe is, like, people have been thinking about the Earth. Like, this is only the place where we live, you know. So what I thought is, like, in last 5-6 years, people have been talking about this Earth. They have been talking about air pollution. They have been talking about the rivers. They have been talking about forests. So that is what, I mean, everyone has a feeling to do something good, but definitely there are some problems going on. But so what I think is, like, as a journalist, I mean, the era has gone that you are a journalist and others are not. And you break the story and others don't do. Anyone can break the story now. So you should be more smart, because people are getting smart. And then the use of technology has to be to make the people's life better, you know. So, I mean, we are people who can inform the people. So we have the responsibility to inform people, and we can do everything. So that's why we need to be smart, and as others said, we have to be more smart than others to say that we are a bit faster than you, you know. So the way that the Earth is changing, or the globe is changing due to technology, has to be taken into, and we need to be more smart in that way. And definitely we can help people to make their life better.
I have a question for Liu Li Tan. So I came in late, so sorry if you've already talked about this. Right. But to me, the Chinese government is caught in between a rock and a hard place. On the one hand, they have to keep up the pace of economic development for the purpose of social stability and social cohesion, which, of course, led to the degradation of the environment. On the other hand, as you yourself has pointed out, China is facing an environmental crisis. So if you were Xi Jinping, the president of China, what would you do? What can you do?
Good one.
I mean, it's imperative to develop the economy. But on the other hand, China is a country that's very resource poor, except probably in coal. So what choice do you have?
I'm not. That's why I cannot be the president of China. I think it's too hard. I mean, even we say that the Chinese government has its own problem, but if sometimes I think if I am the party leader or I'm the president of China, I have no real solution at that time. As you said, that there's so many things that are linked to each other. You know, if you want to slow down the economy, there might be social stability problem. If you want to save the environment, you are facing another economic problem. But for me, I think that is what the central government is advocating the local government to do. That you have to change your development style. I mean, you have to make economic developmental model to change it from the previous one to a more sustainable one. That is the central government is doing. At least it is trying to do this. But it's very hard and it takes time. And it needs a lot of new technologies or many other stuff to make things done. But for me, I think maybe we can slow down a little bit in terms of economic growth. To at least we have to protect the people. I mean, you don't have to care one lake or the ocean. You have to protect the people there. If there is a problem about the health or about the human body, you have to take care of it. If that is the price, I want to pay that.
The great gift for me as being chair is I often get to ask the last question. So I do have a last question, and I'm going to give a choice to each of our panelists. Would you like to talk about what your biggest challenge has been, what the most difficult part has been, or what you're proudest of? So of those three, you may choose one, please. We'll be here all night. So, Ramesh, why don't we start with you, Ramesh Bruchel from Nepal. So either your biggest challenge, what was most dangerous for you, or what was most rewarding?
See, I'll go for a rewarding thing. The most important thing, I mean, the rewarding thing is like, I got to know the world better, you know. So that is, I mean, the journalism has given me the way that I can interpret, I can learn about the things, I can roam around, think differently, talk differently, and that is what I got it in last decade. So that is the reward for me. I mean, people have been doing a lot of their jobs, but when you have the responsibility to do something, and it makes you happy, and I feel like I'm environment reporter. When I'm reporting environmental issues, I think like, okay, yes, I'm doing the thing that that makes happy to others as well. So it is earth, it is water, it is air. I mean, I'm talking about the things that people need. So it's so wonderful to be talking about those things as an environmental journalist.
Okay, Lisan, this is your question from China. which of the three would you like to answer?
Challenge, okay. There are a lot of challenges. For me, myself, my work, because I'm working for a Chinese NGO, the concrete challenge is that we cannot register as an NGO, say we are a company, which means that we cannot raise money from the public. So we have to get money from foreign foundations, which generates another problem, that the government is not happy. So you see, every problem is related to another one. That's a very concrete example. Other challenges means that, as the last question I am asked, it's too complex for me myself. I don't know. I have no real perfect idea on how to solve the current situation. I want to do step by step to see. I can do what I want to do. And others, I don't know how to. I have no solution to other many other big picture. I have no solution to that.
Rosalia Omunga from Kenya.
Okay, I'll talk about the most dangerous incident that occurred.
Rosalia, would you speak a little bit closer?
Okay. Yeah, so I'll speak about the most dangerous thing that occurred or near occurred. So I was going to the northern region of Kenya, and I was covering stories on sanitation and environment degradation in the area. It has been affected by some tree that we call Mathenge tree. It's an invasive species. So on our way back, there's this community. They've just invaded a place, some spare land, and they've invaded. They've built makeshift tents, and that's where they live. So we got off the car to get out to see what's happening here, and what they live so close to the road. And this community, well, they don't really speak. Kiswahili is the national language of Kenya, and they don't really speak it very well. So we were not communicating very well. But when they saw our camera and our car parked there, they communicated with each other. So this guy came with a jerrycan full of petrol, and he was threatening to blow up our car, to pour petrol on it and light it up. But what happened that saved us is that an army car came by, and a car that's full of army men, and those, they really fear those guys. So they took off, and we also took off. So that was very close. That was quite dangerous because we were in the middle of nowhere with no help. Then another time we were all arrested because of getting into private property, trespassing. So I was investigating a story on this very huge golf course that's coming up, and it's been acquired through unsettling people, you know, displacing people from their land. Then the land was fenced, and the water pan they used to use is within the golf course, so they can't access it. So I was given that story by someone, so I went out to investigate it. So we found our way into the golf course. And then who happens to drive by? The manager on his inspection tour. So he told us, "You guys, you're trespassing. Can you come with me?" So he detained us, asked many questions. We were not intimidated. Then he later released us. But I never did that story because I never really finished doing that story. I got to find out later that the owners of that golf course, the who is who in the government of Kenya, owns a cottage in there. So they are cottages, and they were all coming up. Cottages that they rent throughout the year and go for holidays when they are not in use. So I didn't really continue pursuing that story, but we were released eventually.
Gustavo Valedros, how about you from Brazil? Which one are you going to answer?
I'm going to answer all of them.
All of them? All right.
No, because it's quick. I mean, like Hamesh, I think it's really rewarding to be an environmental journalist because it happens to go to very different places. But that's the most dangerous things because you have to take the most dangerous transportation to get there. So that's my two questions answered in one. But the one that I really want to answer really is about the challenge, because we are in a point, as I didn't have much time, but thanks, James, to give me the chance of speaking about InfoAmazonia. The work we are doing in Brazil is very into using technologies right now, and I'm fascinated by that, and I have a lot of pleasure with the work I'm doing. But we got to a point, lucky enough, where we have to prove that people are going to use this or have a relevance on the way we're telling the stories. So over the next years, we really go into a technology, some of the things that we're looking at this week, like water quality sensors, air quality sensors, or a lot of mobile apps. I think that's the way to go, but we still have to see if people think that's the way to go. And so we in the end, we realizing that technology, of course, the way we develop technology is so important, but engaging people, strategies for outreach, and meeting people on a nice room and talking face-to-face with them, it's essential for our projects to be very successful. So that's our challenge, reaching the people.
James Vaughn, you have the last
all
word.
All right, the last word. Okay.
Before he speaks, I want to say why he gets the last word. I think it's really important because he's the executive director of Internews Earth Journalism Network. So he's responsible.
Yeah, it's all my fault. Well, all these guys, they all spoke for me to a certain extent. I mean, I certainly agree that the job has its own rewards and it has its own challenges. For me, the biggest reward is I get to work with these people, and that's not a cliche. It really, I mean, this job can be difficult, both first as a journalist, you know, often facing very difficult odds to cover these stories, and now as a media development practitioner I have to raise money and I have to organize events like this, like the conference we're doing. It can be really challenging. It can really suck your energy. But, you know, then I get to actually sit down with these people who have become my friends and who face these tremendously difficult challenges, and they still work hard at it, and they still do it with a smile. And that's the best part for me, is to be able to work with them, and not just the people up here on the panel, not even just the people in the room, but all over the world. Every country I've been to, I've run into people working on these very difficult issues with passion, with commitment, with dedication, and with a sense of optimism, which is hard to sustain sometimes. And that, to me, is the greatest sign of hope. And I really believe there is a lot of hope for us. And thank you.
Thank you so much for joining us tonight for Internews on the Green Beat in the Developing World. And many, many thanks to our wonderful audience here on the radio and on the Internet. And, of course, for our outstanding panel and our moderator, this has been a very, very interesting for me program, and I think for all the audience and your questions and your attention, it has just been very informative. I'm still thinking of everything that we've discussed tonight. I'm Ann Clark, Chair of the Environment and Natural Resources Member-Led Forum. This meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California celebrating more than 111 years of enlightened discussion, and that includes the 1970s, by the way. And I would like to salute the 1960s because I was even there for that. So we are now adjourned.